Now, space travel has always enabled or been enabled and limited by the available technology. It was the technology developed during and after the Second World War that allowed the first satellites and the first manned space flights for the Apollo landings. The Soviet moon landing project failed in large measure because they didn't have the necessary technology. At present, we just simply don't have the technology to land humans on Mars. In November, the United States will launch the Mars Science Laboratory rover to Mars. About the size of a small family car and with a mass of 1 ton, this mission will push our current technology to its limit. We don't know how to land anything heavier than that on Mars. Now, obviously, new technologies are going to be needed to get humans on Mars. Even sending humans to orbit, but not to land on Mars, would push our current capabilities. In 2010 April, I travelled to Florida to attend a conference opened by President Barack Obama. One of the conference sessions was titled Jumpstarting the New Technologies to Take Us Beyond. By beyond was meant beyond low Earth orbit. Did you know that no human has been higher than 510 kilometres above the Earth since 1972? The space station is only at 400 kilometres. This jumpstarting session was moderated by Norm Augustine, who we heard speak in Program 1 of this space show series. Now, Norman was the chair of Obama's committee that reviewed United States human spaceflight plans. That was the committee that delivered a report recommending the cancellation of President Bush's Back to the Moon Constellation project. So we now have Norm Augustine introducing Ed Liu.
I'd like to introduce our panelists first. I'll do that, and I'll do it very briefly. I don't do justice to them. And then we're going to start at the other end of the table and just work this way. And when that's over, then we'll turn to those of you who are in the audience. First, of course, is Ed Liu, who has a Bachelor of Science in Engineering from Cornell. He has a PhD in Applied Physics from Stanford. He was a NASA astronaut for 12 years. Flew the space shuttle twice, and I believe he was the first flight engineer on the first American flight engineer on the Russian Soyuz. He spent 6 months on the ISS, and is now program manager for advanced projects at Google. So it's an interesting job transition and a great perspective for us.
Wanted to make the point that this is all about innovation in some sense, because I think what the general public, what the United States taxpayer really wants out of NASA is for them to do innovative things that amaze them, right? They want them to do. They want to see value for their money. They want to see NASA doing things, right? And you hear people talking about it. I think the president probably used this word 4 or 5 times in his speech. Probably used the word innovation 4 or 5 times, and you hear it everywhere. And the question is, how do you drive innovation? How do you get a group, you know, as large as NASA to be innovative? And over the years, I've come to the conclusion that there isn't a special formula for it, but there are certain things that you can do that make an innovative environment possible. And to a large extent, I think that is the ability to move quickly. I think innovation really is speed in a lot of respects. And what that means is the ability to do tests of things, to try new ideas, see what works, to iterate, to try things over again. And that means a high pace of operations. At Google, we use the phrase launch early, launch often. And we use it, we apply it to projects that are launching. When people have new ideas, you know, you can try them out. When you want to modify some piece of some product, you can do so, see what works, and then either change it back or decide to go with it. And in order to do that, though, you need to have the infrastructure such that you can do things quickly. So we spend a lot of effort on building the system such that the launch process, launching a new product, is relatively easy. Not to say that the work that's done at NASA is like software. It is completely not. But the concept of building your infrastructure such that you can do tests easily and try ideas easily and bring them to fruition in, you know, not in decades, but in years, and see what works and then change it, I do think does hold over. In my years at NASA, I remember how often we were in a situation where we would have a good idea, and there would be no way to try it. There would be, you know, if you could only get some flight test information, we would have been, you know, we would have saved ourselves years of arguing. But instead, we may argue about it for years because there was no flight opportunity. So the lesson, I think, is really get yourself to the level of a, you know, a rapid development program and think like a rapid development program where your time scales are short. You're not necessarily trying to bite off gigantic chunks, but you're trying to bite lots and lots and lots of small chunks. And build a program around lots and lots of small chunks. And I think that that is the kind of mindset that you need to be in to drive new ideas. That's what gets people thinking. That's what gets people excited when you have this opportunity to get lots of small victories. And when you translate that over to NASA, what does that mean? I think the equivalent of what we call launch infrastructure at Google, which is, you know, the ability to push new code quickly, try tests quickly, and so on. The launch infrastructure is really our, at NASA, which is real launch infrastructure, which is, you know, the launch systems. So I would argue that moving to an architecture that has more rapid launches, lots of rapid launches, even if they're smaller, is worth the payload penalty you take. As you all know, the larger the rocket in general, the larger the payload fraction. But you're going to take a payload penalty from doing this. But I think you gain in an innovation bonus in that you now have engineers have the ability to try things much more easily, much more rapidly, and without as much sort of risk of failure. If you set up your mission such that, you know, maybe you've got a mission every 6 months or 1 year, when you're, or maybe every 2 years you've got a test opportunity for your team, boy, you're not going to try anything terribly exciting, because if you only get a test opportunity every couple of years, you know, you better make sure that you don't try to, you know, you don't do something too outlandish, because your next opportunity doesn't come up for a few more years. And I've seen that mentality at NASA. And I think that the way to change that is through a structural change. I think that to translate that back to launchers, perhaps a medium-scale launcher, you know, perhaps a little bit larger than a Soyuz, or perhaps, you know, up to double the size of a Soyuz, that sort of class launcher, but where the requirement was placed on it that it could launch very, very rapidly without using up all of NASA's resources. And, you know, you get a lot of operational scale from doing that. The other advantage to this is not just in the development side of things, the development side of payloads and things in deep space, which is really what NASA should be doing, and we heard today, but from the pure operational side of things. The faster you get, the better you get at being faster. You know, and we see that here at, right here at Kennedy Space Center. When our launch rate was low, things became difficult. Processing became more difficult. The launch teams, the launch prep teams, everything became more difficult because they weren't in an operational tempo. The faster things got up to some limit, things got better. Of course, there's something there. You can go too fast for any given system, and Shuttle did run up against that some years ago. Shuttle's limit is perhaps about 7 or so flights per year for that particular system. But what that means is that you should place the design requirement on your systems such that you can reach a high operational pace. I think that we should be shooting for something like, you know, once every week, once every 2 weeks, that sort of type of tempo with our requirements. And for real, I know they talked about that for Shuttle back then, back 30 years ago, and I think that there was some fudging of numbers when people said that the Shuttle would launch, was capable of launching that frequently, because it really wasn't. But if you go to a simplified system, a Soyuz-type system, but, you know, an American-made Soyuz system, I think we could do wonderful things with that. So I'll stop there.
That was Ed Liu, a former NASA astronaut and now program manager for advanced projects at Google. On this evening's Space Show, this is Program 7 of our series bringing you the entire conference on the American Space Program for the 21st Century. The theme for tonight is Jumpstarting the New Technologies to Take Us Beyond. Our next speaker chose the topic investments in the future. He is introduced by panel moderator Norm Augustine.
Second, we'll hear from Bobby Braun, who has a PhD in aeronautics and astronautics from Stanford, some 20 years' experience in doing design and analysis of planetary systems, and that includes the Mars Pathfinder missions. He was co-chair of the NRC review of the NASA Institute for Advanced Concepts, and he's currently NASA's chief technologist.
First of all, good afternoon. I've been thinking a lot about technology in these last few months. I've been thinking a lot, in particular, about NASA's technology programs. And I wanted to start by what I've been doing is reading about technology and about how NASA did technology in the past and how NASA has a possibility of doing innovation and technology in the future. And a couple of things have jumped out at me. There's been a very consistent set of external recommendations coming from a number of reports. Both pointed out the importance of technology and innovation for NASA, and in fact for the nation through NASA. In fact, both of these committees pointed out that NASA over the past decade had been effectively eating its seed corn, eating its investments in the future by being perhaps too mission focused. What I've done here is listed the technologies or the capabilities that are called out in these reports. Each of these reports goes through and identifies in great detail the capabilities that are lacking and the capabilities that need to be invested in for NASA to advance beyond low Earth orbit. They identify the capabilities and the technology investments needed for NASA to go to all the places that you heard the President speak about today and all the places that we in this room and as aerospace engineers or folks interested in our space program have been talking about really for decades. And what you see here is a marvelous consistency among these reports. That speaks to a couple of things to me. First of all, there are clearly some very well-defined capability areas that NASA does need to invest in if we're going to go beyond low Earth orbit. A number of independent panels have all come to that same conclusion. Second of all, and this is perhaps the disappointing part for me, the technologies and capabilities that are called for in a report like Pioneering the Space Frontier from 1986 are actually quite similar to the technologies and capabilities called for in the Augustine report of just this past year. And that, to me, speaks to the lack of progress that we've made. Of these reports, my favorite is actually... sorry, Norm. My favorite is actually Pioneering the Space Frontier from 1986. I would encourage any of you that are, you know, in college, in high school, that are maybe listening today, to get a hold of that report. It's really remarkable. The way that report starts out is with technology. The very first page talks about the importance of technology. In fact, what they do in that report is they start by talking about the way it was in this country in 1935. In 1935, we were just beginning transcontinental air travel. We were still actually delivering some mail, not very much, but some mail by Pony Express. And it jumps forward 50 years into the future to the time that that report was written in 1985. And it talks about all the technologies, many that have come about through our space program, navigation technologies, prediction of weather technologies, and many other technologies that nobody in 1935 would have been able to predict. These are largely what I would call disruptive technologies. Some of them had plans and had roadmaps and were, you know, well-funded. Others were things that just came about through largely through innovation. The report then talks about the year 2035, and it says, well, what are the technologies and what are the missions that will be available, that will be possible in 2035? And I think in 1985, that panel had a hard time identifying that. Just like it would be hard for someone from 1935 to predict the future of 1985. It's hard in 1985, or even today, to predict the future of 2035. And one last thing I want to say about 2035, which I get from that report and also from the President's remarks today, it's important to realize that the students in our nation's universities will be two-thirds of the way through their professional career in 2035. None of us at this table will be sitting at a table like this, right? There'll be others. And they're in universities today, and they'll be two-thirds of the way through their career. My son is in ninth grade. My daughters are in middle school. They'll be halfway through their professional careers in 2035. We need to invest in technologies, not just for what it will bring to our space program today, but we need to invest in technologies for the capabilities that it will give that generation to do the things that we would like to do and that are talked about in many of these reports. And what I want to point out here is we're investing in a broad portfolio of technologies through a range of technology programs. We actually need a diverse set of technology programs. We need technologies that are planned from the top down, where we set high-level goals for our human exploration enterprise. We translate that goals into architectures and missions, from missions to spacecraft and technologies. And then we have a nice flow down that we can plan certain technologies investments. But we also need disruptive technologies. We need to invest in research and technology in a broad portfolio approach, because we don't know every advance that's going to be made over the next couple decades. Just like the folks doing, looking back at 1935, certainly couldn't predict every technology advance, in particular, you know, this one, the communicator from Star Trek, right? That was a hard one to predict, that it would come to fruition. The internet would be another great example. So what we actually need in NASA is a range of programs that span all the way from concept to flight. And through these programs, that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a number of the technologies that have been studied, frankly, for decades now, and that have remained in the realm of paper study, and we're going to take them into laboratories. We're going to prove them out, prove the fundamental physics that are holding those technologies back, take them into flight in a relevant environment, and make them real so that they can be adopted by our missions. But there is one point that I do want to make here. And the point really is that, in my view, what the president's budget request really represents is a balancing of NASA's three core competencies. These are longstanding competencies that NASA has had since its creation in 1958. These are the technologies, one, of research and technology, which has long been an underpinning of NASA, of spaceflight hardware development, and of mission operations. And when I look at what the president's putting forward, and I hear the president speak about technology and innovation, what I see is really a balancing of that, where research and technology is brought back up into, perhaps, in my view at least, the proper balance with those other two very important competencies of NASA. In doing so, what that will enable is new approaches to NASA's current mission set, or entirely new missions altogether. It will allow NASA to be part of the innovation engine within this country, for NASA to sit, if you will, at the grown-ups table with the other research and development organizations that make a part of our federal government. And it's for those reasons that I think, frankly, that it's the right approach. I want us to take just a minute and talk about the Space Technology Program, because Doug is going to go into much more detail into the Exploration System Mission Directorate technology programs. The Space Technology Program was set up principally to be what I call a technology push program. All right, it's not a program where we're going to be investing in technologies for the next mission. In fact, if there is a technology for the very next mission, in my view, that should be sponsored by one of the NASA mission directorates. The Space Technology Program is set up to be outside the mission directorates and to look at what I might call broadly applicable or non-mission focused technologies. These are technologies that could impact a wide variety of customers and could affect a large number of NASA missions, missions of other government agencies, and industry missions. Now, the Space Technology Program is set up with three major divisions. We have an early stage innovation component, and this is a component that has been lacking for a number of years in NASA. And this component is going to go out and seek the best ideas, wherever those ideas may be, visionary concepts of our future. The game-changing technology program is going to take some of those concepts and take that little bit of physics that's holding that concept back and prove it in flight. And the final piece, the cross-cutting capabilities program, is going to take some of those technologies that we prove in the lab and prove them, take them into flight in the relevant environment. This program is set up to work in a competitive manner. Almost all of the awards are going to be made competitively. It's going to be an open process that involves industry, academia, NASA centers, the other government labs. As I mentioned, it's a program that's looking for what you might call broadly applicable or non-mission-focused technologies. So I'd like to close with just a couple of thoughts. One, there have been a consistent set of recommendations made both by Congress and a number of external panels that have driven NASA to the development of the technology approach that we're putting forward today. Two, our planning process is really moving rapidly, and actually it's, in my view, it's going fairly well. We're putting a lot of detail into these technology programs, and we're going to be ready to roll those out at the beginning of the fiscal year. Three, through these programs, both the space technology program and the ones that Doug will describe in a moment, we're going to develop new technologies, new capabilities that are going to allow NASA to do an entirely set of missions. We're going to use these capabilities to get humans into deep space. We're going to use these capabilities to improve our robotic explorers. We're going to use these capabilities to improve our knowledge and understanding of the Earth. And then finally here, I want to definitely point out that a NASA focused on innovation and technology is important for the agency, but it's also important for the nation. NASA serves perhaps a unique role to inspire and motivate our young people into educational and career paths in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I know that firsthand. I'm a product of NASA's educational programs. NASA got me hooked at a young age through a summer program at the Langley Research Center, and they actually kept me involved in graduate school through the Office of Education and some of their programs. These programs are very important to me. You know they're also very important to our administrator, Charlie Bolden, and they're also very important to this nation. It is a unique capability that NASA can provide. In addition, I also want to point out that the NASA centers are full of intellectual capital. And that intellectual capital, while it's working on some of the greatest challenges in human spaceflight or in exploring our solar system, that same capital can also be applied to major national needs here on the Earth, major societal challenges like energy, prediction of disasters, weather, national security. These are all things that integrate and cross right into our space program. And so that is certainly another area that these programs can contribute. Thank you.
That was Bobby Braun, NASA's Chief Technology Officer, speaking to the topic Investment in the Future. The theme for tonight's episode has been the space show, the theme for tonight's space show has been jumpstarting the new technologies to take us beyond. This has been Program 7 from the Kennedy Space Center, the host for President Obama's conference on the American Space Program for the 21st century. Previous programs in this series are available for download at www.southernfm.com.au/space. That's www.southernfm is one word lowercase. .com.au/space. I'm Andrew Rennie, producer and presenter of this series.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.